This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So I'm very excited about my next interview. It's with John Aitchison. He's a wildlife photographer and a filmmaker, and as I've said in the interview, a poet. He's written a book called The Shark and the Albatross. I think he's a philosopher too, whether he wants to admit to it or not. Subtitled Travels with a Camera to the Ends of the Earth. He has worked with the BBC, National Geographic, PBS, Discovery Channel, The Frozen Planet, Life Stories. The list is quite endless, really. This John has traveled the world. He's got a lot of insight. He's got an ability to notice. He talks about that. He talks about this idea that we're not really very good at noticing or listening, and we're not taught how to do that. And there are these, what he refers to as these subtle signs in and all around us in our environment. And the closer that we look, the more details that we're going to see. He refers to that as privileged access, which is really beautiful. He talks about this notion of there's no substitute for spending time. And the book is full of stories. John is clearly full of stories and memories and ways of connecting with others and the world around us. You're going to love the book. I hope you're going to love this interview. Stay tuned. John Aitchison online as well. But the book is called The Shark and the Albatross. And lean in a little closer and listen carefully to this next interview, John Aitchison. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by a very special guest today. John Aitchison is with us. He is a photographer. He's a writer. I'm going to call him a poet as well, but we'll let him talk to that in a second. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And so where are you currently? You're about 6 hours ahead of us, I think. You're sitting where?
Yes. I'm at home in Scotland, on the west coast of Scotland.
West coast of Scotland. And what's the sun doing there right now?
We haven't seen the sun for quite a long time. It's been quite wet this year. Quite wet Julys we have.
It sounds like the opening of someone's autobiography from Scotland. We haven't seen the sun in quite a long time, period.
I saw a sign the other day that said, "Today's rain is tomorrow's whiskey," which I thought was probably quite good for Scotland.
I would think that's bang on, yes. So you've written a book, The Shark and the Albatross, subtitled A Wildlife Filmmaker Reveals Why Nature Matters to Us All. And I think our listeners need to know that you've been working with the BBC for many years. My understanding is I think you have your own production company. You've been filming and photographing. You have an incredible passion and sense of purpose around wildlife photography, won many awards too, which and remarkable, really. Your CV and may I say congratulations on the book. I'm absolutely loving it.
Oh well, I'm delighted to hear that. Thank you very much. It was a sort of distillate of quite a long time spent filming, as you say. I've been mainly working for the BBC, although I'm not employed directly by them. So I've worked for other people as well over the years. I guess it's 25 years now of filming wildlife programs. Okay. All over the place.
So I need to tell you, and maybe we'll come back to this, but and I had mentioned it in an earlier text to you, but I had a dentist appointment this morning, and I sit down in the chair, and they often play movies while you're watching, I guess to distract you from all the unnecessary pain that they're causing you. And no kidding, up comes a BBC, not Frozen Planet, but Under the Seas, narrated by David Attenborough. I couldn't believe it. And I just thought, you know, I had too many tools in my mouth to tell the dentist that I'd be interviewing you later today, but I just thought it was pretty interesting timing.
It's quite funny, isn't it? I guess it's very difficult to have conversations with dentists, isn't it? They ask you questions and then you can't answer them.
It's a very odd
thing. I give you the pictures to look at.
It's very odd. I'm going to read a quote from the introduction to your book. Quote, what I like most about Aitchison's approach is that implicitly he views the living world as sacred, close quote. You know, I called you a poet in my biography of you. I don't know that that appears on your website, but can you talk a little bit about that sense of the sacred in the work that you do and the discoveries that you've made?
I was pleased with Carl's introduction, actually, because I hadn't thought in those terms, but I think he's absolutely right. I think there is a sense that when I'm in the natural world and it's really natural, which isn't the case much of the time, but you do go to places and you do have, even quite close to home sometimes, those moments when everything just falls into place and perhaps you hear a bird singing or you see something unexpected. And there is there's a sense of the very special that comes through in those moments, which I think is actually a kind of secular, sacred feeling, in fact. And as I get older, more and more, I feel anger that the natural world is being damaged. And I think that anger, that hurt, comes from that sense that this is something that shouldn't be damaged, that we don't have a right to damage. And that is a sense of sacredness, of untouchableness about nature, which when we lose that and just despoil it without thinking, I think is deeply wrong, and it hurts. So, yes, I think he hit the nail on the head when he said that. It does ring true.
John, I couldn't help but think as I was reading through your book and thinking towards our interview, there's a sense in which, you know, the environment and environmentalists and the movement itself, at least in the West, has really kind of taken off, a cottage industry, a subculture, if you will. And yet, so there's this sense that we are environmentally friendly or aware, and yet, as I read your book, I just thought, wow, we really actually aren't even close. Like we've got a long way to go. That's sort of what I took from it. And I think that's maybe my connect with the sacredness of it all, but the poetry of it, the mystery, the beauty, you know, of what does surround us.
I think that grows as you spend more time. The more time you spend looking, the less you realize that you know. And that nature is unlike other areas of interest in that way. I think that we're very lucky if we're interested in nature, because it seems to be endlessly fascinating. The more you learn, the more you realize there is to learn. It just goes on and on and on, expanding in front of you. And you know, many areas of human endeavor, that's not how it works. You come towards a limit of what you can find out in many areas, but nature's not like that. So in terms of where it's going, I think you're right that there is an increased awareness, and especially in younger people, I think, because of schools partly actually are particularly good in primary school, especially. My children had a lot of environmental education. It drops off a bit in secondary school, but it's there in their background now. But we don't take that up very well when we get older. I think we all get busy and society doesn't really reward environmental thinking very well. It just sets it aside as a thing that you kind of know about, but you can safely ignore it, and there's no approbation if you behave irresponsibly towards the environment. So we need to change that. I think it's getting late to do much. We do rather little, and it's the clock's ticking. We need to be doing more than we do.
Well, I guess there's a sense in which, why bother if it doesn't seem to affect me in the here and now, right? There's a sense
That's exactly
of
right.
Yeah.
I can get away without doing it because nobody else is doing it, so no one's going to notice if I don't do it.
Yeah.
But of course, if you do that, that's the same as not voting or other things, isn't it? Oh, what's one person's vote going to count? It's not
going
to make any difference.
The dam may break, but you know what? Probably not in my lifetime, so, you know.
But actually, now we're getting towards the point where it's really only a few decades away.
Right.
These are the critical two decades now for the climate, for instance, and for biodiversity as well, for habitat protection. We're into that phase now where really crucial things are changing, and they're changing quite fast. And because I travel so much, and I go to wildlife filming is generally done in the very best places available anywhere on the planet now. So if I'm asked to film lions, which I have been doing during the last year, it's in the Masai Mara Reserve in Kenya, which is a really special place, perhaps the best place in Kenya to film lions. And then when I was there, three of them were poisoned and died.
Wow.
So I find this, you know, I go to these places and in each place people are saying, it's not as good as it used to be, you know,
or
climate's changed and things are really getting screwed up here. The bears are dying because there's no ice. Or it's really drastically changing, very rapidly changing at the moment.
I find it really interesting and paradoxical that you've, and tell me about this and work with me on this, but you've spent your life looking through a very narrow piece of technology, a lens,
yes.
And yet
yes.
I couldn't get more of a wider perspective from your book.
Good of you to say that. I mean, I think that's what I was trying to do, really, because the narrow technology is a type of way of looking at the world through a television camera's lens, but it's narrow also because television programs are filtered. They're commissioned and then produced and edited to a purpose, and the purpose is generally a commercial one, and generally they don't work in the commercial sense if they don't interest a lot of people. They have to appeal to millions of people, and they have to sell. And if they don't do that, then you won't get commissioned to make another one.
Right.
So they run the risk, and they don't always fall into this category, but they do run the risk of set dressing the natural world so it looks lovely and that there's everything's fine. You might go, for instance, to that lion example. I might go somewhere where it does look fantastic, and you can film what looks like a sort of timeless Eden full of elephants and lions and giraffes. But it doesn't have any sense at all that that's rather a small area, and all around it is habitation and fields and no lions, elephants or giraffes. So by omission, those programs can actually tell a lie, really.
Right.
But of course, it doesn't work to make a very negative program saying, look at what else there is around this where there's no wildlife at all. Because, in fact, we don't really watch wildlife programs for that purpose. Most of us watch wildlife programs as a kind of escape, an hour when we're not thinking about the news or habitat destruction or, you know, any negative things at all. We just want to look at something beautiful for a bit.
Are you a poet who happens to be a photographer?
I don't know if I'm a poet, really. I've written a few poems in my time, but hardly ever. But I like that type of writing. I think the people who... films and writing are the same in a sense, in that if you want to engage people, you can do it with facts, but you can do it far more effectively with emotion and with beauty, because beauty inspires emotion in us, I think. And if you can relate to feelings people have had in the past or might have in the future, or subjects which move people, family or sacrifice or kindness or generosity or risk, those kind of things, everybody knows about those things. We've all had experience of danger, of loss, and those apply to the natural world just as much as they apply to human life. If you can write in a way that brings those things to life, then, or film in a way that brings those things to life,
of
then
course.
The programs are far more effective and books are far more effective too. But there are great examples. I'm not original in this at all, in that I read a great deal of natural history writing, and I really appreciate writers who do that, like Barry Lopez, for instance, is a genius at that style of writing, of nature writing. It transports you and it engages you emotionally, and that's really what I was trying to do, I suppose.
Yeah, well, and I think you did it very well, but I guess too, I think what I was sort of getting to in a way with the question was just this ability. I think doesn't a great poet, doesn't a great writer, doesn't a great filmmaker really have this ability to observe and to listen? And I just saw you, your sense of patience, you talk about that in the book actually a great deal, or at least it certainly comes through. And, you know, I see you sitting on a block of ice, camping on a block of ice for 10 days and imagine the madness of that on one level.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the sheer sense of focus and intention on another.
Yes. I mean, there is a sort of waiting, of course, and in fact, thinking of the experience, the examined life, if you like, is more interesting.
Yes,
you know, than just sitting there waiting for something to happen. So, you know, I do it partly because it's a nice way to pass the time. Also, I'm so lucky to go to these places that to sit there and grumble about the cold and wish animals would hurry up and turn up would just be a travesty. Having had the luck and the good fortune to be invited to go and be there, it would be a waste not to relish the moment. But of course, the moments can be quite long. But I find waiting quite easy because it's never waiting in a void. There's always something going on. It may not be the thing you're trying to film, but there's always something else going on. So, in a sense, those are the things that often I'm not supposed to film, and so I watch them instead. And then the words come rather easily to describe those things, as long as there's a moment to take it in and maybe jot a note or two, or even record sound, because often if you just make an audio recording of a place, or perhaps even people chatting, when the time comes to relive that and write about it, it comes flooding back, and it's very evocative sound. So I take a little sound recorder with me and sometimes record notes into it, and sometimes just record the sound of the place.
I love how you say it. I love how you say at one point, and by the way, I think we've already mentioned it, but the book, The Shark and the Albatross, you say there's no substitute for spending time. And absolutely. I love that. I mean, that sense of commitment and research, and there's a history to that. There's also a sense of future to that I just love, that there's got to be this passionate, committed intent that goes along, I don't know, with pretty much everything we do, it seems to me.
I think so too. I don't think you can't hope to do anything well if you do it in a trivial way. If you don't think of it as something that's worth putting time into, you'll never be very good at it. And so I think it's really important, and I say this to people who ask me for advice, and I say it to my kids, you know, it's really important that you should do something that you like and that you're interested in, because if you have to put in all these thousands of hours to something that really doesn't interest you, I don't see how you could ever be any good at doing that thing, because it's so difficult to focus for a long time on something that you don't believe is important.
Right.
I mean, we all really, I mean, maybe it's hobbies that many people occupy themselves with and put that effort into, but I think everybody's got something, some passion. It may not be their work at all, but what a dull thing it would be to live for many decades and not be interested in anything.
I love the, I'm pretty sure it's in the, near the end of the book where you talk about your son and his interest, I believe, in photography as well. Mm. And I think this might be where this whole notion of, and maybe I'm going to say you're also, you know, I'm getting inklings of philosophy here, you know, the examined life out on a block of ice. I'm liking that image right now. But you talk about, the phrase was look properly. And you said to your son, you know, whether you come home with pictures or not, this is about paying attention to the details. This is about listening. This is about observing the world in a I don't know, healthy way, holistic way. I don't know.
I think it's to do with noticing, really, and knowing to notice is something that you need to either come upon for yourself or be shown how to do it, because it doesn't necessarily we're not taught this anymore. It would have been absolutely standard in all humans' education, say I don't know, 50 generations ago, because you would die otherwise if you didn't know the significance of very subtle signs in your environment about what was going to happen.
Right.
You definitely wouldn't survive. And we've lost that, really. I mean, maybe we pay attention to the same degree to other things in our modern environment, and they keep us alive too, perhaps. But I think that fine attention, that sort of, it was, there's a British writer called Roger Deakin who called it fierce looking. And I think he was absolutely right. It is a kind of, there's a kind of focus which is quite fierce sometimes, where you really are paying attention, and it can be to anything. It doesn't have to be natural history, but I think we learned it through our interaction with other animals, particularly in the past. And that was what kept us alive. If we were hunter-gatherers and there were dangerous animals there and also animals you needed to catch, then if you weren't good at fierce-looking, you didn't find them.
Right.
It's in our genes.
I want to talk about the elusive lynx, because for me that was a really interesting... I mean, all the chapters are very interesting. I love the way you frame it around a trip, around an animal, and so on. And I also want to talk a little bit about what's this book really about? You know, is it really about animals? I love that about it. But I think I mentioned to you as well offline, my daughter Victoria is going to absolutely love this. She's got a sense for others and a sense for that whole world in a way that I haven't noticed before. And we're doing what we can already. She's eight to water that. Brilliant. And to nurture that in a cool way. Yeah. So tell me. So I guess my question is, do I need to get binoculars for Victoria? Because you talked about...
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, you talked about...
I think soon, yes. Easy-to-use ones. Yeah, soon.
Okay.
Because that was a revelation to me when I was a little bit older than her.
Yes.
That moment of first seeing the details is all about detail, I think. When you realize that there's more and more and more detail, the closer you look, the more detail there is, the more fascinating the things become, the more detailed the behavior is, the more beautiful the animals are when you see them close. And it may be that you can get close. There are lots of things you can get close to without binoculars. But if it's birds, you can't generally. So, yes, I think binoculars made a big difference to my life, certainly. And that sort of privileged access that you get through seeing things eight times closer or in hides. You know, if you go to a bird reserve and you can get into a hide and you suddenly see these things that don't know you're there behaving naturally, it opens a whole new world up, I think. And I was talking, actually, I worked with David Attenborough on a program about amber some time ago.
Okay.
And we were talking about our subject, about this natural history subject, making films. And he said, we're very lucky with our subject, you know, because we could be just as interested in, I don't know, medieval pottery, and it would matter to us just as much. Yes. But nobody would be asking us to make films about it.
That's right.
And he's asked quite often. People say to him, "When did you first become interested in wildlife? When did you become interested in wildlife?" And he says, "When did you stop being interested in
wildlife?"
Yeah,
that's great. That's such a great line. It's so good.
He's always on the nail, David. But the point is, of course, all children are interested in wildlife. It just, some more than others, maybe, but it just dwindles because they're not encouraged so much in our society anymore, because most adults don't know that much about wildlife. So access is limited. We don't live in the countryside so much anymore. More than half the world population lives in cities now. Literally more than 50% are urban. So access to any wildlife at all is much more limited than it used to be. It used to be just there. You go out and find things. You make toys from fir cones. And my mother showed me loads of ways to make toys from bits of tree and plant and things, which she did when she was a child. We're losing those things. But encourage Victoria, definitely. If she's interested, great.
We absolutely will. And I think your book has affirmed that in a variety of ways. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of your work as well. And I probably watched much of it in the past. That would be my guess. John, tell why you as a child and not another child? And I'm always interested in motivation. I'm always interested in, you know, the nature-nurture debate. Was it the household you grew up in? Was it the books that you read? Was it some sort of epiphantic encounter that you had as a child alongside of the binoculars? You know, obviously it's not a one-time thing, but it was clearly touched a nerve with you in a way that, that it doesn't with others. And then you continued to water it. It's fascinating to me.
I think that's that continuing to water it thing is really important to this, because there are these little germs of interest, aren't there? We all have these sparks, these moments, which maybe are inherent or encouraged or both, and they happen when you're young. But if you're not almost shown that they can be significant by somebody else, then you may or may not have the character or the inkling or the drive to take that thing on. And some people's characters just do that, I think, and they're quite bloody minded and they'll just pursue something that interests them. But I think the majority of people are not like that. And if you're lucky, as I think I was, then you can be encouraged in a very clever way by adults who don't tell you everything about the thing you're interested in. They just encourage you to become more and more interested in it. So I think I was lucky because my mother likes plants especially, but she's very interested in natural history. And my dad's an engineer and he likes cameras. So there are two things which, when I was quite young, I was just exposed to photography and to natural history. We'd go on walks in the countryside and my dad would often have a camera with him, which he could then lend me later on and so on. And lucky again, because I had a friend at school whose father took natural history stills. He took photographs of animals, and so Andrew and I would go off with his dad when he was going photographing birds. We weren't particularly paying attention to what he was doing, but it was, you know, we were going to these interesting places, and he was I remember going to a reed bed once in a marsh, and we went to help him camouflage the hide. So he was going to go into a hide and take pictures, which I never did, but we went there through this reed bed in our wellies in the mud and all these birds around us and creeping through this place that you weren't supposed to go to normally, and then getting a view of the lagoon that was beyond it with birds on it, and thinking, wow, this is amazing. You know, this is a really different world that I never knew existed. And I think especially important, there was an adult who thought it was important. Whereas I might have, if I had been interested in that, if I'd come across that on my own, which I don't think I would have done,
right,
I would have perhaps thought, well, nobody's going to think that this is significant. They're going to think this is, you know, a foolish thing that children do, rather than an interesting thing that adults might find interesting.
Well, this kind of goes back to your comment about sort of being taught how to see, right? Or being taught how to notice. That kids do have that ability. And it's, isn't it amazing that, I don't know, we as adults, we as a culture, we as a human race seem to squeeze that out of children at a certain age, you know, all of us included.
It's observation. It isn't, I mean, you play loads of games as a child, don't you, which is to do with looking.
Yes.
Games in the car when you're on journeys.
That's
in the ice
right.
High,
that's or, right.
Lots of observational type things.
Yes.
What color is this and all sorts of stuff. And then you stop doing that and you start having to remember received information. It becomes all about being given information and having to cram it into your head. And that's not how it works when you're looking at the world at all. You go into the world and you notice stuff and you wonder what it is. And maybe you follow it and you perhaps then go and learn about it. But it's not, that doesn't come first. What comes first is noticing. And we forget, I think, how important noticing things is. I used to notice stuff all the time. I used to find money on the floor because the milkman would drop change or whatever, or I'd see birds in trees and point them out to people and they'd say, oh, I didn't see that. And I started realizing that I was noticing stuff, and then of course you encouraged to do it more just because it surprises people, or you know, it's quite handy finding money on the floor.
There's a career. Hey, if this whole photography thing doesn't work out for you, there might be a career in that.
In noticing.
Well, finding money on the floor.
Finding money on the floor. Yes, it doesn't work anymore. It's all credit cards now.
That's right. Hey, we're going to have to wrap it up soon. I'm sad about that, and I hope we can do part two together, but I want to talk a little bit more about just really quickly about what this book really is about, and the title and the image even of the perspective shift of the albatross, of the shark. You talk about it in that chapter. It's fascinating to me. I don't think you're a photographer at all. I honestly, man, this is a philosophical treatise. It's wonderful on so many levels. And obviously it's about animals and it's about your experience and humanizing them and so on. But boy, I don't know. There's a lot of dots that are connecting for me.
No, I'm really glad to hear you say that. I mean, I'd like to know what you think it's about too, but the shark and the albatross, the reason it's called that is because when I was filming tiger sharks trying to catch young albatrosses,
yes,
in an island in the Hawaiian chain, the young albatrosses have to leave their island and fly away across the sea, which they've never done before, and they can't fly particularly well when they start. They can sit on the water, but sitting on the water near the island is very dangerous because the tiger sharks know that the young albatrosses leave at certain times of the year, and in July, and so they come and try and intercept them and eat them. And so it's extremely dangerous, but the albatrosses don't know that. So I was filming the young albatrosses knowing that and feeling bad about it. And the albatrosses were beautiful and young and lovely animals. The sharks were 3 meters, 4 meters long and quite frightening, I thought. But there were divers filming the sharks while I was filming the albatrosses.
Sure.
And we took sides. The divers wanted the sharks to eat. I wanted the albatrosses to escape. And I thought, this is going to happen with the audience too. They're going to have to take sides because this thing will be edited one way or the other. And then I thought, well, actually, given that sharks are dwindling very quickly because people kill them for their fins, and their numbers are crashing, and that we were finding albatrosses on the islands, young albatrosses dead through having ingested plastic, which their parents thought was food. Here we are, humans, doing this to the natural world, to both sharks and albatrosses, and whose side are we on, actually? We shouldn't be thinking, I like predators or I like prey. We should be thinking, I like nature. We should be on nature's side. So that's why I called the book The Shark and the Albatross, because for me it summed up that sleepwalking almost that we're doing through the natural world, not realizing how much it's changing because of people, and that we could be doing something about it. And largely we just don't, but we could and should be doing something about it. So the book's full of stories about filming and about animals and about wild places, but underlying it often, at least, is a thread of, come on guys, let's think about what we're doing and do a bit more in favor of nature. Are we on nature's side or are we not? And let's decide consciously. And then if we're on nature's side, let's do something about it.
Well, it really is a lesson in living the examined life. And, you know, honestly, there's a philosophical edge to this and an existential edge, frankly. In some ways, it raises more questions for me in on some levels, and yet is just this marvelous, I was going to use the word honorarium. That's the wrong word, but it's this celebration of the mystery and the wonder and the beauty that we miss. You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, I don't want to be crass about it, but you know, you're no longer seeing the change on the floor. Well, maybe that's a good thing. You know, the money, because you can look up and around.
Yes, I look up as much as I look down these days.
That's right.
But yeah, I think you're right. I think the philosophy behind it is, from my point of view, anyway, is that the closer you look, the more you see, and the more you realize that beyond what you can see is another level of things that you can see if you keep looking.
Yeah,
and
nice.
It starts to fall into place as patterns. And those patterns are, I find, the most fascinating thing. If you start seeing reasons for things, complex reasons, complex systems, which you're seeing parts of, then you start to see the world in a different way. The world is made up of many interacting systems, and we can't just pull one of them out without expecting it to have consequences elsewhere. It's endlessly fascinating. I'd encourage really anyone to go and become interested in nature as a hobby, but as a thing that's good for you as well. It's something which lifts all of our spirits.
If you have
that there.
And I think your book does the same. And I hope it becomes an introduction to many, many people to taking it on as a hobby, as something else to think about, read more, dig deeper. You know, I think that it's certainly opened up a new world for me. It's The Shark and the Albatross, travels with a Camera to the Ends of the Earth. Wildlife filmmaker John Aitchison has been our guest today. He works for the independent production company Otter Films. He's worked with BBC and National Geographic and PBS and Discovery. The list goes on. John, thanks so much for your time and your generosity today. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, David. It's been lovely talking to you, and I hope perhaps we'll get a chance to do it again.
I hope so, too. Part 2 is coming up soon, I hope.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.